Well, hey, thank you for coming tonight. We are in Joel chapter 3, verse 9 through 16. I'll begin reading in chapter 3, verse 1. But basically what this is, and you'll decide as you go through this, this is the restoration of Israel. And as we talked, the restoration of Israel is going to lead to the great day of the Lord. And the day of the Lord is going to be both deliverance for the believers, but also judgment for the nations. The nations will be judged. The believers will be delivered. And so with the restoration of Israel, as soon as it begins, chapter 3, verse 1, in those days, which is a phrase for the end times, and at that time, most likely projecting into the distant future, so Joel writing, around 360 B.C., that's where we've placed it here, but it may be anywhere on this timeline. It's not dated, so we got to kind of take a guess, but, you know, place it where you will. But he's talking now, and no matter where Joel's at, most likely he's projected into the future, when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem. That restoration, as we've talked before, is the restoration that began with the dispersion of northern Israel in 722 by the Assyrians, and those northern ten tribes, never came back. Many of them fled down into Judah and were, you know, lived into the city of Jerusalem and around the city. They then would have, Hezekiah expanded the wall to accommodate the expansion of the city with the northern Israel fleeing down to Judah. But then Babylon came in 586 and took them captive. All 12 tribes would have went captive, and all 12 tribes would have came back, but and rebuilt the temple, Zerubbabel's temple, which was converted into Herod's temple. And that temple then was destroyed, and then the Jews again were dispersed in 70 AD. So that was the final dispersion. It would have began in 722, then they had a Babylonian exile and return in 539, but then again a dispersion in 70 AD, and there's never been a full restoration of Israel. Now we do know 1948 they became a nation again, but most likely these things didn't happen. This was just setting the stage for Israel to be recognized as a nation at some point in the future, potentially, although they could be, you know, wiped out and scattered again, like, you know, the Islam wants to drive them into the Mediterranean Sea. That may happen again, and then we just have to wait again for another restoration. So 1948 is an interesting date, but we are still waiting since 722 BC for the restoration of Israel. That's what Joel's talking about. It says, in those days and at that time when I restore the fortune of Judah and Jerusalem, I will gather all nations, again, the key, nations, and bring them into the Valley of Jehoshaphat. The Valley of Jehoshaphat, we try to figure out what that is. Is that the Kidron Valley? Is that Armageddon? Or is it just some place where the name actually means it's Yahweh and the word judge or judged, and it basically means Yahweh judged or Yahweh will judge or Yahweh has judged. It's the valley of either the name Jehoshaphat, the king, identifying some location coming out of the Kidron Valley down towards the Dead Sea, where Jehoshaphat won a battle. Or it means, it should not be translated Jehoshaphat as the name of the king. It should be just translated the valley where the Lord will judge. So we leave that hanging there for, we could go either way. But understand there's two ways of putting that together. Anyway, there I'll bring them into the valley where the Lord will judge them. And that's what's going to take place. Maybe it's the Kidron Valley. Maybe it's a valley that doesn't exist yet. There I will enter into judgment against them. Of course, where the Yahweh judges, he will enter into judgment. I think Jesus referred to this in Matthew 25 when he says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory, is seated in his glory and on his heavenly throne, he'll judge. Concerning my inheritance, I'll judge the nations concerning my inheritance, my people Israel, and how they dealt with Israel. Now, we can go back, if you take Jesus' parable in Matthew 25, when he says, he judged the sheep on his right, the goats on his left, and each group says, but when did we see you hungry? When did we see you naked? When did we see you in need? He says, when you did it to the least of these brethren of mine. That's what Jesus says. Now, when he says brethren, does that just mean everybody, people? Way you treated people? Could, yes. I mean, it's even preached that way, the way you treat people. It could mean believers, you know, you've treated the believers. Or it could mean brethren. It could be an actual term of brethren, my relatives, my people, my kinsmen, my nation, the Jews. That's what Jesus says, these brethren of mine. Everybody, believers, or is it the Jews? You got to say. Except here you've got a very clear, similar situation, if not the exact situation, where they'll enter into judgment. He'll enter into judgment against the nations concerning my inheritance, my people Israel. Now remember, Deuteronomy is at 32, where the Lord divided the nations according to the sons of God, but took as his inheritance the nation of Israel. So his inheritance was, I'll take this nation for my nation, and now he's going to judge the other nations on how they treated his inheritance, his nation. I mean, it all kind of fits together. For they scattered my people among the nations. 722, we'll throw 586 in there, but that's a parenthesis because they came back, and then were finally dispersed in 70 AD. Because they dispersed. Now again, there's many times they had trouble with the Midianites, they had trouble with the Egyptians, they had trouble with, you know, the Seleucids, the Greeks. But here, definitely I would consider 722 Israel, and beginning in 722 with all the prophets, Amos and Micah, Hosea, talking about this coming dispersion. They always prophesied, but there'll be a restoration. There will be a return. So even as they are predicting this 722 dispersion by the Assyrians, 722, 721, the prophets that foretold it talked about there will be a restoration. So every time this is talked about, there's a restoration. And any time in the Old Testament, anyway, it's talking about destruction, there's a restoration, including Joel. Here's the restoration. For they scattered my people among the nations. So these nations are going to be judged because they dispersed Israel. Now God used the Assyrians. Even Isaiah calls the Assyrians the rod of God's anger. God put Nebuchadnezzar through Zephaniah and Habakkuk and Jeremiah, made it very clear. Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel said it, is his chosen instrument. So they were doing God's will of bringing judgment, but at the same time, God will take people's natures, we've talked about this extensively, and let them do what they want to do, and he'll use it for his purposes, such as Judas betraying Christ. It's Judas's fault, but God is going to use that to advance his program. So we don't need to worry about, well, God is the one who judged. He was using a nation that was willing to do the dirty work, and now they're going to be judged for having done that. It's just interesting because we're not just talking about 722 Assyria and 70 AD Rome. We're looking at nations throughout history and how they're treating Israel. In fact, when you look at Jesus, when he says, when you've done it to the least of these brethren of mine, you've done it to me, it would almost seem like Jesus has just returned after the 70th week, after the seven-year tribulation, and is judging the nations specifically on how they treated Israel at this very day that we're talking about coming up here. In other words, during the tribulation, how the nations came against Israel during the tribulation. So this may be ancient history. This may be ancient history, but there's going to be a day in the 70th week, in the day of the tribulation, that the nations are going to still come against Israel under the Antichrist leadership. Then he talks about what they did, and this would have been some historical events, and again, it's hard to pinpoint when this was. They cast lots for my people. They traded boys for prostitutes. They sold girls for wine and that they might drink. In other words, just for a brief drink, a brief night of pleasure, they traded the Israelites individually. That they're like a commodity, which is very degrading. Now, what have you against me, O Tyre and Sidon, and all you regions of Philistia? He names specifically the Phoenicians and the Philistines. Are you Philistines, which would be interesting, that's the Gaza Strip today. Tyre and Sidon would be Lebanon today. Are you repaying me for something I have done? If you are paying me back, I will swiftly and speedily return on your own heads what you have done. There again is that phrase or the ideal of swift and speed. And we're talking about a yet future event from 722 or 70 AD, or maybe some event that took place during Joel's lifetime. But we're actually, this is projecting it into the distant future. So there's that. It's always there. It's in Revelation. It's in Jesus' teaching. It's in the epistles of these things are coming soon. But yet we wait, seems like a long, I mean, millenniums, centuries. If you are paying me back, okay, verse 6, you sold the people of Judah and Jerusalem to the Greeks that you might send them far from their homelands. Verse 7, see, I'm going to rouse them out of the places to which you sold them, his people. He's going to rouse them and bring them back. And I will return on your own heads what you have done. In other words, I'm going to bring my people back. This might be beginning in 1948. I'm going to begin bringing my people back into the land of Israel, the promised land. And when they're back in the land, you're going to try to do the same thing you did in 722, 70 AD, or Babylon 586. I'm going to draw them back, and by putting them in the land, that's going to get the attention of the nations. Let's take them out again. And it's almost like that's exactly what you're going to see. What the nations did in the ancient history, or at different times in history, when Israel's back in the land, it's like, that's how God, well, it says right here, see, I'm going to rouse them out of the places to which you sold them. You sold them in different places in the world. He's going to rouse them and bring them back. He brought them back from Europe and all around. They're back in the land in 1948, if you want to make it a contemporary application. And I will return on your own heads what you have done. Now, what he means is I'm going to bring them, I'll rouse them and bring them back. Now they're like bait. It's not that Israel's going to take up weapons in all the different countries around the world and start slaughtering the nations. They're the bait. He's going to rouse them, bring them back to Israel, put them in the mousetrap. And when the nations see that, they're going to go for it again. But it's not 722. It's not 70 AD. It's the day of the Lord, where God is restoring Israel, but the nations will respond the same way they did in the past, but this time the outcome will be different. I will sell your sons and daughters to the people of Judah, and they will sell them to the Sabaeans, a nation far away. The Lord has spoken. And now we begin our verses for tonight, verses 9 through 16. I'll read through them, and then I'll go back and talk about them. I'll try to read through them without comment. In the NIV, the English Standard is on your notes. NIV. Proclaim this among the nations. Prepare for war. Rouse your warriors. Let all the fighting men draw near and attack. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weakling say, I am strong. Come quickly, all you nations from every side, and assemble there. Bring down your warriors, O Lord. Now there's a comment. Bring down your warriors, O Lord. Let the nations be roused. Let them advance into the valley of Jehoshaphat. For there I will sit to judge all the nations on every side. Swing the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, trample the grapes, for the winepress is full, and the vats overflow. So great is their wickedness. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision. For the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and moon will be darkened, and the stars no longer shine. The Lord will roar from Zion and thunder from Jerusalem. The earth and the sky will tremble, but the Lord will be a refuge for his people, a stronghold for the people of Israel. And that's where we'll quit tonight. Now that is loaded with a bunch of cross references that it's almost, I think we can almost exactly time that, or at least not the date, but time that in eschatology when that's going to take place. And there's many things I want to say about it, so let's take a look at it. Chapter 3, verse 9. Proclaim this among the nations. That's the proclamation. In other words, this is God telling the prophet, or the prophet speaking God's word. This is the proclamation. Go out to all these nations. And it's for chapter 3, verse 1, in those days and at that time. So this proclamation is going to be at a point in the future. Proclaim to these nations. And the proclamation is, prepare for war. Now, I'm going to say this here, and we'll talk about it later on. If you remember in end times, and I've got verses written down, I just want to put this in your minds. The Antichrist is going to go off, and they're going to try for, it will be some form of world peace. Jesus talks about it, even the prophets talked about it, but Paul talks about it. When everybody is saying peace and safety, disaster is near. So you can even hear the flavor. Not that we're living in these days right now, 1948, it's there, but that doesn't mean that we're there today, and as far as these events. But you can hear the nations talking about peace, peace. Everyone disarm. And they were going to get anti-guns. We're all going to make peace treaties. If that were to take place, if somehow the nations were to agree on some kind of peace, and everyone says we're heading towards the utopia, the secular, humanistic, secular utopia, where mankind is going to rise above their disagreements and all find unity. And understand, this is a fantasy. This is not possible, because the evil within man is within man's heart. It's not in some political party. If you go to the left, you go to the right, whichever where you go to this country or that country, you go to any family, you go to any of the males or the females, you go to any race, you've got a sin nature. You've got a sin nature in every person, in every family, in every nation, in every government. You've got a sin nature which, if left unguarded, is going to dominate whatever they're allowed to dominate. So that's where you've got to be. You've got to have character, but you've also got to be on defense. You can't, how do you say this without being sounding so cliche? You can't trust anyone. I mean, history teaches you, the Bible teaches you that. You can't trust yourself. Even the man doesn't know his own heart. You have a sin nature. So there's going to have to be guards and some kind of structure, such as taking responsibility for yourself, marriage, family, government, nations, to guard against the wild free burning of the sin nature. But if we can, as a people, as a universal people, take down all those barriers, no nations, no governments, no family, no marriage, and you're not responsible, you're a product of evolution. It's just not your fault. Everybody's fine. Well, you've taken the whole history off the guardrails, and you're going to crash. Well, when people say peace and safety, destruction is near. And that's maybe what we're looking at here in the end times. So when we say this right here, proclaim this among the nations, I want you to at least consider these may be nations or a world condition that they think they're going to attain utopia by just everybody stop fighting, everybody find some standard we can all agree on, and get rid of your weapons. And that's kind of, I think that's important, because watch this. He says prepare for war, which means they're not prepared for war. I mean, like, for example, you don't need to tell the United States of America prepare for war, because they are prepared for war. They things are in place. Maybe you got to say we're going to war at this certain time, we're going to make this movement, but it's like, oh, we better start making weapons. We have weapons. In fact, we're selling them to other countries. Okay, whatever. Proclaim this among the nations. Prepare for war. Rouse the warriors, which I think maybe there's warriors that are prepared, but rouse the warriors, as we read through this, the warriors may not be prepared for war. There may not even be warriors, because they've dismantled, they've disarmed. This is what you find in the book of Judges also. The book of Judges, the people of Israel had disarmed until Deborah's day, and Deborah had enough, and that's a great story there. Rouse the warriors, let all the fighting men draw near and attack. Verse 10, okay, all the fighting men are going to draw near and attack. And again, without having said it except in the introduction, if Israel's been restored, the place they're going to attack is going to be Jerusalem, or at least Judah, but let's just say Jerusalem. And then it takes this verse 10. What do I got written down here? Let me go back here. Chapter 3, verse 9, in the English Standard Version, the same verse, proclaim this among the nations, consecrate for war. Stir up the mighty men, let all the men of war draw near, let them come up. And again, consecrate for war, prepare for war, that'd be like take your vows, your rituals, whatever you need to do to prepare. Point 1A, the nations think God is calling them to battle to be victorious. They think, just like the Assyrians or Rome or even Babylon, that they're being called by God to invade Israel because they're going to be successful. So it's going to be an easy sell. Everybody's going to get ready. We're going to battle. But point B, the Lord is calling the nations to march into battle to be defeated this time. The plan is different. Revelation 16, 3 through 16. We could flip over there and read it, but here it is right here. Oh, I should go there and read it. I'm going to go there and read it. Chapter 16 of Revelation, because there's some verses here in Revelation that kind of tie into this. And keep in mind, a few weeks ago and other times, we've read Zechariah. When the Lord descends, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives will be split in two, forming a great valley. And then he'll go out and fight like he fights in the day of battle. It says in Zechariah, all the nations will be gathered to Jerusalem on that day. Exactly what's being said here. But now in Revelation 16, I've got 13 through 16, but I'm going to read 12 through 21. And I want you to notice there's an earthquake in these verses that splits Jerusalem into three parts. Now, I understand when Jesus descends on the Mount of Olives, it will split into two parts, forming a great valley, and all of the area down south there will collapse and run like a plain. And then Isaiah and others talk about Jerusalem being lifted up. So there's going to be a topography change when that mountain is split, Mount Olives is split. You see it in Ezekiel. You see it in Isaiah. There's another reference, just like Isaiah's, when Jerusalem's lifted up, and you see it in Zechariah. And now in Revelation 16, it says there's an earthquake, it's going to split Jerusalem into three parts. So I'm reading in chapter 16, verse 12. The sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its waters dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. Kings from the east. Are going to be coming. Now, this right here, the bowls are being poured out. We've already gone through the seals. We've already gone through the trumpets. These are the bowls, the last of the series of three, the three series of seven, and it is the sixth of the seven. So we're at the end of the 70th week. Then I saw three evil spirits that looked like frogs. Now, it's interesting, in the Greek, that is the word unclean spirits. I'm going to throw this out at you, okay? In the book of Enoch, which we mentioned last week, an unclean spirit was called unclean. Just throwing this out there just as a reference. We were talking last night about how you got to be careful with Enoch. It's not scripture. But Jesus and the Gospels called the demons unclean spirits. The reason they're unclean in the book of Enoch is because the Nephilim, the sons of the descendants of the angels, or the sons of God, who produced children, the flood wiped them out, and their spirits didn't go anywhere. Their spirits just left their dead bodies and then roamed the earth. That's where the demons, we've talked about that made that speculation for years. And the demons are disembodied spirits because their bodies are dead, and a dead body is unclean. And so the reason they're called unclean is they come from dead bodies that have been wiped out, but there's no place for the spirit to go. It's a dead body spirit. It's an unclean spirit. So here it says evil spirit in the NIV, but if you look at the footnotes, it's called unclean. Just throwing it that. That's one of those things that I was reading through and studying Enoch. It's just like, oh, that's why they call it unclean. Potentially, that's what Enoch says. That's not scripture. That's just the way to. Anyway, three evil, unclean spirits came out that looked like frogs. They came out of the mouth of the dragon. That would be Satan. Out of the mouth of the beast. That's the Antichrist. And out of the mouth of the false prophet. So each Satan, the Antichrist, and this false prophet each send out an evil spirit, an unclean spirit, which may mean the unclean spirit is functioning in those individuals. Nonetheless, we can't go down that road now. They are spirits of demons. Demons are not fallen angels. Demons are a separate class, unless you're going to make fallen angels and demons a synonym, but you're going to run into some confusion. It's best to keep them separate. They are spirits of demons, which are disembodied spirits from the children of the sons of God, the Nephilim. And they are spirits of demons performing miraculous signs. So now these demons are manifesting in human history again, performing signs, spiritual, that, this must be true. Remember, the postmodern age is coming against science because they want their own reality, their own views, but they're going to need some substance, some source of authority to override scientific evidence. The thing that they're going to get, that they're going to find, is demonic manifestations. Once you've got demonic manifestations, science takes a back seat, because this is the way the world works. This is science. Yeah, but now we've just entered into a realm that we don't understand. It's demonic manifestations that override scientific fact and do miraculous signs or false signs and mislead everybody. And that's where I think the postmodern age is heading, into demonism. They have to. Otherwise, science is going to roll right over the top of them. Because you can say all you want to say, but eventually, universities that are actually doing science, or medical institutions that are actually doing science, or NASA, who's actually doing science to get their ships, their rockets to function, mathematicians who are actually using math, are going to say, this postmodern, you can't just live in your own reality because we've got science. But if postmodern can rise up and say, yeah, but look, poof, ho. It doesn't matter about your numbers. It doesn't matter about your science, because poof, this is overriding your physical reality. Well, that's what's going to happen here. If it happens in your day or not, I don't know. But here, it's what's happening here. They come out of the mouth of the dragon, the mouth of the beast, the mouth of the false prophet. They are spirits of demons performing miraculous signs, and they go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them for battle on the great day of God Almighty. The great day of God Almighty is the day of the Lord. It's Israel's going to be restored, or is in the process. Even the book of Revelation is in the process of being restored. It's the day of the Lord. So these go out and gather all the kings of the east, but all the kings for the great day of the Lord. Verse 15, behold, Jesus says, I come like a thief. Blessed is he who stays awake and keeps his clothes with him, so that he may not go naked and be shamefully exposed. Verse 16 picks up where we left off. Then they, the demons, the unclean spirits, gathered the kings together to the place that in Hebrew is called Armageddon. Now that's Har Megiddo, the mountain or the mound of Megiddo. Har meaning mound. Translated in here, it's in English. Armageddon, but Har Megiddo, it's the hill of Megiddo, which gives the impression it's the valley of Jezreel, which is where the hill of Megiddo is. But Armageddon is, the valley of Armageddon, it's a valley. Now, if it's up north in northern Israel, just south in Galilee, on the south side of Galilee, or if it's talking about the valley of Jehoshaphat, I mean, they may be the same place, just leaving that out there. Maybe the Lord judges in the valley of Jezreel. The seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air. And out of the temple came a loud voice from the throne saying, it is done. Then there came flashes of lightning, rumbling, peals of thunder, and a severe earthquake. Now when you see lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, especially where God is involved, it is what we call a theophany. It is God leaving his throne, leaving the spiritual unseen dimension, and entering into our world, entering into our atmosphere, entering into, like when he came down to Sinai, we saw this theophany. We've studied this in the Minor Prophets. Whenever you see this shaking, this thundering, this lightning, earthquakes, it's God coming into his created universe. The world can't handle him, and he comes in, and this would be very similar to the Lord Jesus descending to the Mount of Olives. So that, I mean, I'm just saying that could be it. No earthquake like it has ever occurred since man has been on the earth. Now, when it says that, that means the earthquakes that took place during the flood of Noah, which caused the fountains of the deep to burst forth. So tremendous was the quake, the great city, and we're going to assume that's Jerusalem, was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations collapsed. So the whole world is shaking, the continental plates are moving, Jerusalem splits into three parts. This is clearly, I'm going to say clearly, you can decide, God entering into history. God remembered Babylon the Great and gave her the cup filled with the wine of the fury. Every island fled away, and the mountains could not be found. From the sky, huge hailstones of about 100 pounds each fell upon them, and they all cursed God on account of the plague of hail, because the plague was so terrible. Okay, the main thing about, I'm just looking at that for two reasons. One, getting a general picture. It's very similar to what we're looking at here potentially, but mainly the gathering of the nations, the demons being sent out to gather the nations were being gathered for the day of the Lord. In other words, those demons going off to gather the kings for battle is exactly what we read in Joel chapter 1, or Joel chapter 3, verse 9. Proclaim this among the nations. Prepare for war. This is God saying, proclaim this among the nations. But then in Revelation 16, it's the demons going out and bringing the message, which is not unusual. In 722, he used the Syria. 70 AD, he used Rome. 586, he used Babylon. Here, it's parallel. They don't have to be going in the opposite direction. In other words, every time, things are going the same direction. Satan's activity is going the same direction God's activity is doing. God's just using what Satan's doing to bring about his plan. Thus, Judas and the cross. Okay, so that's what's being said right there. Go back to the notes on page 1. Just in reference, Zechariah 12:9. Says, and on that day I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And on that day, he's talking about this same day, eschatologically, I will seek to destroy all the nations. God's purpose on the day of the Lord, on the great day of the Lord, is to destroy the nations, to bring judgment on the nations. Joel's just got done saying it. Zechariah 14:2-3 says, for I will gather all nations for battle against Jerusalem. And pretty clear, Zechariah 14 is not Assyria or Greece or Babylon or Persia or the Romans. It's never happened before. This is an eschatological event we're waiting for. It's the same thing. For I will gather all the nations for battle against Jerusalem, and the city will be captured, the houses looted, and the women ravished. Half the city will go into exile, but the rest of the people will not be removed from the city. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. And that is the great day. They're invading Israel, thinking they're going to be successful, but all of a sudden, no. That may be the Mount of Olives return when the Mount of Olives split. It may be the splitting that we see in Revelation 16. Nonetheless, it's what's going to take place here in Joel. Because point two, the nations are mentioned three times in the next three verses. Chapter 3, verse 9 says, proclaim among the nations, consecrate for war, draw near and come. See the commands? Consecrate, draw near, come up. And that they're coming. And that could be those demons bringing the nations together. Chapter 3, verse 11, hasten and come, all you surrounding nations, and gather. Again, the command, hasten, come, gather. That's verse 11 and verse 12. Let the nations stir themselves up and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. So three times, verse 9, 11, and 12, they're being told, move over here. Move over into, and it seems like it's pretty clear, they're coming to Jerusalem, which seems to indicate the valley of Jehoshaphat would have to be part of Jerusalem, which makes you wonder, what is Armageddon? Is Armageddon part of the valley where the Lord judges? Again, I some of these things, I'm going to make statements and I get out here, it's like, I don't know how it comes together. We don't even know if the valley of Jehoshaphat exists yet. But this seems to be in Jerusalem. The valley where the Lord judges would seem to be very near the Mount of Olives in the Kidron Valley. But that you've got Armageddon hanging there. Is that another battle? Or is Armageddon, it says, hey, Megiddo. We know where Megiddo is, and there's a tell there, the remains of the city. Is that what it's talking about? It doesn't say they gather in Jezreel Valley. It says they gather at Armageddon, which could be Jezreel Valley, but you know, don't lock yourself in. Nonetheless, we go on. Those announcing the proclamation likely are angels, I wrote in point three, but if you allow verse 16 to be in there, they may be the demons being sent out, and that's not unusual for God to use demonic presence. Chapter 3, verse 10. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am a warrior. Now, what's interesting about that is why are you turning your farming equipment into swords? One, we need everything to be a weapon. We don't have time for farming. We need everything converted into weapons. Or it could be some level of disarmament. They don't have weapons. They're being told, prepare for war. It's like, prepare for war. Shut down John Deere. Convert it into some kind of a tank manufacturing. And we got to turn everything into military equipment. It may be that they're unprepared. In fact, I'm going to suggest as we read through these verses, they are not prepared. The world is not prepared for this call to war because they spent the first 3.5 years of the tribulation disarming, peace, everything's going to be fine. But by doing that, they're setting the stage for the biggest conflict the world has ever seen by disarming. Just consider what took place with World War I, and then World War I was the war that ended all wars. Then comes World War II, and after two world wars, we brought universal peace. We established the League of Nations, the United Nations, all these things. And then we have the biggest series of wars we've ever had, and we're still at war right now, nonetheless. Verse 3:9 and 3:10, the preparations are made, including everything possible to become a military weapon. And likely every man is also armed. So I'm going to say this, present this right here, that they need weapons because everything has been converted into peacetime for production. They need warriors because there are no warriors. Everybody is a commoner. Working in the industry or the factories or the whatever for this peaceful community. Think again what we're looking at. Think again about the fourth generation that we've seen repeated in Scripture, and then remember what takes place in Revelation. There's the bread, a bag of gold for bread, a day's wages for barley and grain. You remember that verse. But do not, one of the seals, but do not damage the oil or wine. It says, do not damage. What does that mean? Don't open those up. But give everybody, you've got wheat or barley and for a day's wage. You get your meal, basically what it says, you get your meal for your day's wage. You work, you get your food. But don't damage the oil or wine. So it's not like there's no food. It's the oil and wine, the luxuries are over here, but the common man is over here working. It's the elite have taken over and driven the middle class into poverty. It's what always takes place in northern Israel when they fell. It's what takes place in Jeremiah's day. It's what was taking place anytime you go through that fourth generation. It's what's happening in our day today. The elite are getting power, and they're driving the middle class into poverty. It's happening. I mean, I'm going to stop with that. And that's what's going to take place in the future. So, in this place where you need no weapons because the elite of the world have got an agreement, we're all just going to prosper and grind our people and give them food. And think about China. Think about communistic states. This is the way their people are treated. You're living in a bubble. We've been living in a bubble where everybody's equal and the middle class is large. Eventually, I mean, and prosperous. Eventually, that middle class is going to get smaller or shoved into poverty, and the elite is going to get bloated with all the power. It's the way countries go. It's the way Tower of Babel was that way. Now, if you've converted all your weapons or disarmed because you don't need them, you've got peace treaties with all the elite, all the Bill Gates around the world have agreed that we're going to get along, and you don't need warriors, what we need is workers. And if we're going to have this, we're going to have foods, we're going to have agricultural equipment. So everybody's just working to just stay alive. Now all of a sudden God says, no, 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 no. The elite don't run history. I run history. Call the nations to war. Prepare for war. We're not ready for war. Well, you better get ready for war. Even the demons go out, call them to war. And now all of a sudden they need warriors. And here's this verse right here. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Everything you put down here to produce food, you need to stop and turn it into weapons because something's gone wrong with this elite ruling class. Now, this is exactly opposite of, we're going to look at it, what Isaiah and Micah are going to say. I'll show you that in a minute. But also notice this, let the weak say, I am a warrior. Let the weak, who's the weak? This guy right here, the weak. You're just a factory worker. You're just a guy that works on a farm. You're just out producing food. You're the weak. But now guess what? Let the weak say, I am a warrior. Now, I remember singing a song in church about that. Let the weak say, I am strong. It's a Christian song. It's like, no. This is the end times where you've got everybody is oppressed by the elite ruling class, and they've been forced into labor for a day's wage. Meanwhile, the elite are ruling and prospering, getting more and more productive or powerful. This is God and the demonic forces saying, okay, the common man, say you're a warrior. Get up here, and you are now a warrior, and this is going to happen fast. And you're going to hear this. Even Joel is written in a staccato, hurried style. It's like, oh my gosh, this plan is unraveling. World peace that was forced upon us is unraveling. As soon as Bill Gates starts challenging this or whatever, the demons that are ruling the different nations, there are still ruling, even though the nations may come together and say, we're going to have world peace, there's still demonic powers, the rulers and authorities in heavenly places that are still struggling with each other. Do not think Satan's kingdom is working together. Jesus even said it. If Satan's house is divided, how can it stand? He wasn't saying it's not. He was saying this isn't even going to work. Satan is divided because that's what demonism is, not demonism. Exorcism is just one power driving out another power. Who's the most powerful force? Keep that in mind. Turn the page of the notes, and you can see right here, they're beating their farming equipment into military. And what's interesting, point two on page two, this helps you date the book, potentially. If Joel is 360, and that's where I've placed about, this verse is mimicking Micah and Isaiah. Two clear verses that were written Isaiah 740 to 681, you could easily say 700 BC, and Micah 750 to 686. Who wrote it first? Micah and then Isaiah, or Isaiah and then Micah? They were contemporaries, and both of them write about the kingdom age when, here it is, right here, Micah writes, when the Lord returns, when the Messiah reigns, he shall judge between many peoples. Okay, he shall judge between many peoples. That means nations. The Messiah will judge between many nations, which is exactly what's taking place in Joel, exactly what's taking place in Matthew 25, exactly what's taking place in Zechariah. He will judge between many nations. That's what takes place on the great day of the Lord. And shall decide disputes for strong nations far away. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. When the Messiah comes, you will not need a standing military. You will not train for war anymore because there's no need. The Messiah is ruling, and if you remember, he's ruling with an iron scepter. He's not ruling with niceness. He's ruling with an iron scepter. It's my way or the highway. I'm the creator. I'm the Lord. This is the way we're going to do it. And everybody will either do it or perish. Thus, world peace. Rome did the same thing. But you're not going to get world peace by saying, let's all just disarm and pretend there's no differences. Someone's going to have to establish their rule. And Jesus will do that. And when he does, there will be world peace. There's no need for a standing military. Neither shall they learn war. Nation shall not lift up sword against another nation, because you don't dare do it, because anyone who does is against the Messiah, and the Messiah will take care of it. So you might as well take all of your military production and put it into farm equipment, because also the earth is going to be so productive during the kingdom age that you don't have time for war. You're going to have harvest every month. It's just going to be crazy productive. He will increase light, and it's apparently the temperature, if you look at it. In other words, he's going to use global warming, create global warming to his advantage. That's out of my league as far as science, but there is going to be seven times as much light, seven times as much daytime, and the crops are going to grow. It's just interesting because, well, I can't go anything more about that. Isaiah, same verse. He shall judge between the nations, is what Isaiah says, and shall decide disputes for many peoples, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Those are both verses from 700 B.C. Joel, whenever Joel is written, is basically mimicking those verses. But before you get to those verses, you're going to have to go through this time period where you're going to think you're in the millennium. You don't need weapons. You're going to think you don't need any warriors. And you've got some kind of elite ruling class thinking they're the Messiah eventually. And Antichrist will arise and think he is the Messiah and continue to enforce this. But God says that's not the way history ends. History ends with you guys coming against Israel being drawn in. And you better get your common workers as warriors and get your peace equipment turned back into weapons, because we're not in the millennium yet. It's not time for Micah and Isaiah. We're doing Joel first. And that's, I think, Joel is building on those verses. I've got also Psalm 46:9. He makes wars to cease throughout the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the shield in fire. You could read all of, I got written down to read Psalm 46. That would be my intention, but I'm going to stop because we're going to run out of time. Psalm 110:6, he will judge the nations, heaping up the dead. He will crush the leaders far and wide. I also wrote, read Psalm 110 because it adds to our discussion tonight, the whole chapter. I'm going to pause that. Isaiah 17:2-14, ah, the thunder of many peoples. They thunder like the thundering of the sea. Ah, the roar of nations. They roar like the roaring of mighty waters. The nations roar like the roaring of many waters. But he will rebuke them, and they will flee far away, chase like chaff on the mountains before the wind and whirling dust before the storm. At evening time, behold, terror. Before morning, they are no more. This is the portion of those whose lot, who loot us, and the lot of those who plunder us. And that Isaiah 17, oh, I really want to read that. My gosh. That's talking about this event right here of when the nations are coming. All those are talking about that same event of God judging nations. Isaiah 17 includes the destruction of Damascus. And it's been a problem, a question for eschatology, because Damascus has never seen this battle. Damascus has never, in a sense, fallen. You can still go to Damascus and find the straight street of Acts. It's still there. It never went through war. Damascus has always endured. Damascus seems to be sitting there, unjudged, waiting for Isaiah 17 to take place. It's there. It's there. And when that takes place, it will be in these days right here. So those, all those verses or chapters, I could go off on those, but let's keep going. Point three, weak are converted into warriors, just like farming equipment is converted into weapons. These weak may be the common untrained men that are factory workers or farmers forced into labor because of their middle class being forced into poverty. A sense of haste and unpreparedness is in these verses, is the result of universal disarmament under the leadership of the Antichrist. As a question. And here's two verses. Peace had been the political position, but the Lord calls them out of their Hamas, their social violence, social oppression, or their political oppression, and instated peace to gather for war, instead of peace to gather for war. And then 1 Thessalonians 5:13, which is talking about the eschatological events, Paul writes, while people are saying there is peace and security, and Paul is most likely referring to Matthew 24 because he's going to address that, there is peace and security, then sudden destruction will come upon them as labor pains come upon a pregnant woman, and they will not escape. That's Paul's words. When people are saying peace and safety, then they're heading for the great day of the Lord, and it'll come, and they can't escape. They will not escape this. I'll read Joel chapter 3, verse 11. Let me just read chapter 11, or verse 11 and 12. Here it is. Chapter 3, verse 11. Hasten and come, all you surrounding nations, and gather yourselves there. There, I think, is Jerusalem. Bring down your warriors, O Lord. Now that switches gather your nations there in Jerusalem, and then they turn and look at the Lord. Bring down your warriors, Lord, and here comes the descent of the Lord. The nations are earlier in the nations had earlier atalke. This is just where I'm saying the nations had earlier attacked and destroyed Jerusalem. They think they're going to do it again this time, but not. You can even see the difference. Turn to page 3. You can even see the difference in Luke chapter 21. The difference between 70 AD and the valley of Yahweh judges. And this would be a future date. When is this? 70 AD, first verse on page 3 at the top. Luke 21, 20 through 24. When you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you will know that its desolation is near. When it's 66 AD, 67 AD, when you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, Jesus says, talking about the end of his generation in 40 years, you'll know it's time for Jerusalem for the desolation to occur. It's going into its final destruction. Then let those who are in Judea flee. That's why the church went across the Jordan River up to Decapolis, up to a place called Petra. That's why John took Jesus' mom, Mary, and moved to Ephesus. They followed this advice. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the city get out. Let those who are in the country not enter the city for protection. For this is the time of punishment in fulfillment of all that has been written. If it be any of the prophets, this is the final dispersion of Israel. Began in 722, 70 AD, they've never come back. Again, 1948, what does this mean? There will be great distress in the land and wrath against this people, that would be Israel. They will fall by the sword, who? Israel. And will be taken as prisoners to all the nations. They went to Rome and were sold cheap as slaves. There's so many of them, they were sold cheap as slaves. In fact, they probably built the Colosseum, the Jewish slaves, using the gold taken from the temple. They've even found an inscription verifying that. Jerusalem will be trampled on by the Gentiles. How long? Until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Or Jerusalem will be trampled on by the nations until the time of the nations are fulfilled. That's where we're at. We're still in that time frame. That's Luke 21, 20 through 24. The same chapter, chapter 21 through chapter 21, verse 25 to 28. Talking about the day that Joel's talking about here. There will be signs in the sun, moon, and stars. On the earth, nations will be in anguish and perplexity at the roaring and tossing of the sea. Nations in perplexity, the sea, you see that in Daniel, where the sea was, the four winds that stirred up the sea, and coming out of the sea were the beasts, the rulers of the nations that were going to come. Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome was coming up out of the sea because the Lord was stirring up the sea. Well, here, the nations will be in anguish and in perplexity because they were planning world peace. The elite had agreed, they'd taken over universal everything, everyone been forced into servanthood, a day's wage for their meal. Yet don't damage the oil and wine, everything's fine, we've got everything under control. But all of a sudden, nations will be in anguish and perplexity at the roaring and tossing of the sea. They've never seen the Lord stir up situations before, or like this. People will faint from terror. It's uncontrolled. And you can read the seven seals, you can read the seven trumpets, and you can read into the bowls. They don't know what to do until finally that sixth bowl, the demons go off and gather the nations for battle. People will faint from terror, apprehension of what is coming on the world, for the heavenly bodies will be shaken. At that time, they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. When these things begin to happen, stand up, lift up your heads, because your redemption is drawing near. So in 70 AD, when you see Jerusalem surrounded, run. It's coming down. They're going to suffer. Now, later on, when this starts to take place and I regather Israel and then I bring the nations against, now, at this time, relax. Because hold your ground, start looking up, because redemption's coming. Same chapter, same situation. Jerusalem is being invaded. Run. Jerusalem's being invaded. Relax. So this is the dispersion. This right here is what we're talking about in Joel when it says in chapter 3, verse 11, hasten and come, all you surrounding nations, and gather yourself there. They're coming here. They think they're coming for this, like they've done before in history, but they're really coming to the valley where the Lord judges. Bring down your warriors, O Lord. Chapter 3, verse 12, let the nations stir themselves and come up to, here it is again, the valley of Jehoshaphat. Come on, come on, invade Jerusalem again this time. For there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. This time the Lord is sitting there, or is going to return there to judge them when they arrive. They're stepping into the trap. Israel is the trap. Jerusalem is a stone that can't be moved. And when the nations try to move it, says they only harm themselves. That's prophecy. Let the nations stir themselves up and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Chapter 3, verse 13, put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Sickle. Oh, my gosh. I got to see what time it's getting to be. It sure seems like it's running out of time. Oh, we're so close. Okay, sickle, put the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Go in, tread the winepress. Is full. The vats overflow, for their evil is great. The winepress overflows because of the evil. Overflowing winepress, the sickle. Those verses are very similar to what you see. If you turn the page, I've got it written down here. Chapter 14, Revelation 14, 14 through 20. When they gathered the grapes and threw them into... I'm going to go there and read it. Oh, I'm not. I don't have time. Revelation 14, 14 through 20. It says, they gathered its grapes and threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. They were trampled in the winepress outside the city. So here's your winepress. The nations are being thrown in there. They're being trampled. We got point A. The winepress could be the valley of Jehoshaphat, formed in Zechariah 14 when the Lord returns. And a great, it says a great valley, and the people escape out of the valley. The city, the winepress, is outside, could be, and most likely is Jerusalem. And then I've got to go to Revelation 14, and I'm quitting with this. I'm quitting with this. Revelation 14. I'll begin in verse 17. We got the harvest of the earth is what's titled in Revelation in the NIV. Verse 14 through verse 20 is talking about the harvesting the grain and harvesting the wine. But verse 17, just listen to this. Another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sharp sickle. Still another angel who had charge of the fire came from the altar and called in a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, take your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of grapes from the earth's vine. Right here. Because its grapes are ripe. The angel swung his sickle on the earth, gathered its grapes, and threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. Where is that great winepress, and where is God's wrath? If we put it in this situation, that winepress is the valley of Jehoshaphat, and the wrath of God is right there on the great day, bringing it on the nations. They were trampled in the winepress. Where is that winepress? Outside the city. What's the city? Jerusalem. And blood flowed out of the press, that's human blood, flowed out from the press, rising as high as the horse's bridle for a distance of 1,600 stadii, which is basically 180 miles. Now, when it talks about as high as a horse's bridle, you know, however you want to say that, you don't need to think of the entire earth being covered in blood. Because if you're in a valley, the wine press where they're being judged, trampled, slaughtered, blood is going to flow in the valley like a wadi. You know, a wadi, like in Israel, there's dry wadis. During the rain season, all the water runs down the hills around the mountains and goes in the wadi, and all of a sudden, whoosh. In fact, we've been in wadis, but you've got to keep alert, because if it rains in northern Israel, and it's happened before, if it rains in northern Israel, the water builds up, and you may be in a dry wadi. You know, I've been through the desert on a horse with no name. America, you know the song, you know? It felt good to get out. I saw a dry riverbed. You just listen to the song. It's exactly like driving through the Negev. It's exactly, in fact, we listen to this song while we're driving through the Negev, a horse with no name. But what happens is you're in a dry riverbed, and all of a sudden, here comes just a flood of water, and tourists have been swept away to their death because there's water. You don't even know it's coming. It rained 100 miles away and washes them away. That's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about the earth being a blood all over the earth. We're talking about the wadis, the valley of Jehoshaphat filling up with blood if it's outside Jerusalem, and the blood flows for 180 miles. I did some math. Here we go. Very quickly, last thing. Dead Sea right here, all right, Jerusalem right here, the Kidron Valley right here. If it's the Kidron Valley, I would assume the Valley of Jehoshaphat is going to be close. This is complete speculation. Down here is, again, the Gulf of Aqaba. Coming up over here is the other finger of the Red Sea, Gulf of Aqaba right here. The math didn't work out like I wanted it to. In Ezekiel, Jerusalem, after Jesus returns, is lifted up high. Water comes out of the temple and flows to the Eastern Sea and the Western Sea, connecting the Mediterranean Sea with the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea fills up with water, overflows, and then flows down into the Gulf of Aqaba, and this becomes a place where men fish. And they catch the same kind of fish here that they catch in the Western Sea, straight out of Ezekiel. That's what Ezekiel says. This becomes fresh water because water is flowing from Jerusalem through a wadi of some sort or river into the Dead Sea, and then winds down in through here because it gets full. The Dead Sea doesn't flow anywhere. It's the lowest point on earth. And so when it gets there, it can't go anywhere. It just evaporates, leaves behind the minerals. And for centuries, that's why it's so you can float in it. If the same thing will take place, if the Valley of Jehoshaphat, where the Lord judges, is here outside the city of Jerusalem, which it is in Joel, it is in Revelation, it is in Matthew, and it's slaughtered, blood will flow down these wadis into the Dead Sea, which will then just keep flowing, and the distance is 180 miles. Now, I did this math. This is just me doing math. This could be 214 miles if you drive. If you look up how to drive from here to the Gulf of Aqaba, it's 214 miles. That's going on highways. That's too much. I thought, shoot. How about if you flew by air? Straight shot, fly from here. And this is a great, this is an Israeli vacation resort. This if you want to go on vacation, if you're in Jerusalem, you want to go on vacation, you go down here for the weekend. And you get a fly. Straight shot. That's 155 miles by air. Then I did this. I took my own map, and I got a big map of Israel. Well, I took a little scale and measured it. Or 150 to 180 miles flowing in wadis to the Dead Sea and cutting a river to the riverbed to the Gulf of Aqaba. So if you again, if this is winding, see if this is winding, and this is winding, it could be anywhere between, I got 150 and 180 miles. So there it is. If you're gonna drive, it's 214. Of course, it's not gonna go. It's not gonna follow the highways. It's not going to be 150 flying by air. It's going to be coming and wandering through like this. If the blood flows like water, when the water flows out of the Temple Mount, it will have to go down to the Dead Sea and then follow a riverbed down to here. So there would be, I'm saying, that's 180 miles right there. Again, you can see my speculation taking place right there, but it's physically present and ready to go. Last three verses, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. Now, who's making the decisions? I think the Lord is making the decision. I know Billy Graham says, make a decision for Christ, which is correct. But I think this is the Lord. He's the one doing the judging, not the people. They've already made their decision. That's why they've been brought to their destruction. The sun and moon are darkened, and the stars withdraw their shining, because the glory of the Lord is there. The Lord roars from Zion. This is Zion, the Lord's roaring, and utters his voice from Jerusalem. Parallel, Zion, Jerusalem. He is in Jerusalem on earth. He's not roaring from Zion in heaven. Zion is here. It's in Jerusalem. And the heavens and the earth quake. But the Lord is a refuge to his people, a stronghold to the people of Israel. That's the day of the Lord. He thunders his voice from Jerusalem, and everything quakes, but he's here to deliver his people. It's the day of judgment, but the day of deliverance, and that's where we're at right now. I'll pick that up next week. Thank you for listening. I'll pray. Father, we do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We ask again that we'd find hope, encouragement, and direction in these. We ask that we would be faithful to you at this time in history, knowing that these things will come to pass, and we do want to be on the right side of history, living our lives today in a way that would please you and advance your purpose in this age. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.